This is take two, third meeting of the conference committee between the House and the Senate, the combined conference committee for the E-12 Education of Finance Omnibus Bill will come to order. And first on our agenda is a continued walkthrough, and we will begin with Article 3, Special Education, and I will turn it over to Ms. Larson.
Madam Chair, members, in Article 3 of the Omnibus House File 934, Senate File 1030, in Article 3, Section 1, which is in the House only, it has to do with special education rulemaking. It amends existing law and clarifies that the education commissioner must not adopt new education rules or amend existing rules without specific authority. The next number of sections, sections 2 through 5 and 10 and 11, all pertain to the same proposal. It was a proposal that Representative McFarland offered. I understand from Representative McFarland that there is agreement on the part of both the Department of Human Services and the Department of Education to actualize this. The proposal in those sections has to do with third-party billing to facilitate school districts' ability to seek payment for health-related services that are provided to students with IEPs or IFSPs. Then jumping down to Section 6, this is a section of a bill that Representative Sandra Peterson offered. It says that a school district is not required to provide educational services to a non-resident student without an IEP and without a tuition arrangement or an agreement from the placing authority to pay the cost of placing that student in the residential facility. Section 7, which is the same, came in the House from a Fritz bill allowing trial placement at the Minnesota Academies for the Deaf and blind. It's a 60 to 90 day trial placement. Sections 8, 9, 10, and 11 are again from the McFarland proposal on third party billing. Section 12 in the House and 3 in the Senate have to do with appropriations. And Section 13 is a revisor's instruction to update the reference to IEP.
And Mr. Chair, the Senate in the special education article, Senator Nelson is carrying a third-party reimbursement bill that's similar to what the House has, although not the same, and there is not yet a Senate position on that. Sections 1 and 2 of the Senate bill on page R6 and R7 are the same in the House. They reduce the program growth factor for both regular special ed and special education excess cost aid to a 0% growth, but the growth, the aid will still grow based on an increase in pupil units.
Larson. Mr. Strom.
Mr. Chair, on to Article 4, Facilities and Technologies article. The first section in the House bill is the fixed standing appropriation for debt service equalization aid. This number is affected by two things, actually three things, affected by the forecast levels of appropriation necessary for the program. Secondly, the shift comes into play in these numbers. And third, because of the early payback of the maximum effort capital loans, the House has a slightly different amount of debt service appropriation than the Senate.
Mr. Chair, members, the Senate debt service appropriation takes into account the forecast, the shift, and there's one fund transfer that has to be that affects the numbers in this appropriation. And then sections 2 and I guess it's just section 2, but it has a lot of components to it, is the Senator Limmer bill regarding the Health and Safety Revenue Program. There's no cost to this bill. It basically just changes the structure to better define it in statute and what is allowed and what is not allowed in the revenue program. This provision is also carried, although there are some technical differences, in the MDE policy bill.
Mr. Chair, members, on page R6 of Article 4 is the provision in the House bill that eliminates the aid portion of alternative facilities revenue. For school districts that are in the alternative facilities program, the full amount of the revenue would be levy beginning with fiscal year 2013 and each year thereafter.
Mr. Chair, Section 3 of the Senate language is a Senator Chamberlain and Bonneff bill that includes language in the ballot for renewing existing capital project referendum. And then, Mr. Chair and members, the Section 4 of the Senate and Section 3 of the House is language strictly addressing the districts that are members of the technology and information education system that ties, and it allows them to levy in their individual districts for 10 years to finance improvements in that building.
Mr. Chair, members, on page 10, on the House side, Section 4 is the provision that authorizes early repayment of maximum effort capital loans. Essentially, what this provision does is it applies to any school district that received a capital loan prior to January 1st, 1997, and allows that district to repay the full outstanding principal on the loan, the original principal on the loan, prior to July 1st, 2012. And if the district does so, the full liability for the unpaid interest of the district is satisfied and discharged. So essentially what happens here is several districts that have capital loans may be interested in prepaying them. We talked about the fiscal effect of this earlier. These payments would come into the state and go into the repayment fund for the debt service.
Mr. Chair and members, Section 5 of the Senate bill is language that allows WISETA to enter into the Alternative Facilities Revenue Program. WISETA, under current law, would be eligible to be entered into the program in, I think it's 3 years, 3 or 4 years, and this makes them eligible early. Section 6 is a continuation of the health and safety bill that Senator Limmer carried, and it just allows a school board to submit an application for revenue if they have not yet adopted a health and safety policy by a certain date. And then Section 5 of the House and Section 7 of the Senate are the appropriations that Mr. Carl and Mr. Nauman discussed in the spreadsheet.
And Mr. Chair, finally, Section 6 of the House bill on page 12 is the repealer of the two provisions of statute that authorize the aid for the Alternative Facilities Program. Mr. Chair, members, Article 5 is the next article in the bill. The first section in Article 5, which has to do with nutrition and accounting matters, is the repayment in general law for how the state would apply future surpluses that the state receives. If you look online in the bill on lines 73.3 through 73.5, you can see what's being struck here is essentially an obsolete cross-reference. So it keeps in the repayment in its current order that if the state has excess funds, first the cash flow account is restored to $350 million, then the budget reserve is replenished, and then after that, the school aid payment shift is returned to 90%, and then the property tax recognition shift is repaid as well. Section 2 is the levy recognition. This is some language that has to deal with the way that the property tax shift is calculated. Essentially what's happening here is that we're using gross instead of net levies. This will simplify the calculation of the property tax recognition shift, and it also has the benefit of providing slightly larger shift savings for us. Section 3 is the second change having to do with the levy recognition shift, and this has to do with the timing of the adjustments and essentially allows the and requires the commissioner to make those adjustments as soon as possible to the end of the year. Section 4 on the House side is the reestablishment of the shift. The House essentially lowers the shift back to 70% for fiscal years 12 and 13, and then lets the shift bump back up to 90% for fiscals 14 and later.
And Mr. Chair and members, Section 3 on the Senate side mirrors the House language in fiscal years 12 and 13, but continues the 70% payment schedule on into the future. Mr. Chair and members, Section 5 of the Senate bill continues for two more years the capital account fund transfers. School districts under the last 3 years, we're allowed to make an operating capital transfer of $51 times its adjusted marginal cost pupil units, and that transfer is allowed to continue for 2 more years in the Senate bill.
And Mr. Chair, members, in Section 6 of the House bill on page 4, general authority for school districts to transfer funds from one fund to another and from one account to another is created for fiscal years 12 and 13. There are a couple of restrictions on this. No transfers are allowed out of the community service or the food service fund. And additionally, a transfer is not authorized if that transfer would have the effect either of increasing state aid obligations or resulting in an additional property tax authority for that school. Section 5 of the House and 7 of the Senate are the levy aid recognition timing. Essentially, this gets into how those timings are done, and essentially cleans up that process a bit.
Section 6, Mr. Chair, members of the Senate bill, is a collection of fund transfers that were brought to the committee. Primarily, these are fund transfers from the debt redemption fund to the operating capital account. In the general fund, these include Becker, Delano, Elk River, Medalia, Monticello, and St. Cloud. These all were discussed during the aid and levy tracking. Elk River carries, as Dr. McQuay mentioned a few moments ago, an aid effect. The others are all levy. And then the next section of Section 8 of the House of the Senate and Section 7 of the House are the appropriation sections, which were discussed throughout the aid tracking. Section 4 of the Senate bill it relates to the cash flow borrowing, and it amends the permanent law that governs how the school districts will have aid withheld off the regular schedule. Under current law, the Commissioner of Management and Budget determines that the cash flow of the state is in need to avoid borrowing for cash flow purposes. The Commissioner may direct the Commissioner of Education to begin withholding payments from school districts. This occurs within an individual fiscal year. And if that process is effectuated in the future under the Senate language, school districts will be paid interest for the time during which the dollars are withheld. And we think that although we're in discussions with the Department of Finance about the proper number to carry there or whether we need to carry a number, currently the Senate's carrying $300,000 for making those interest payments.
And Mr. Chair, members, the House repeals that provision entirely with an immediate effective date.
And Mr. Chair and members, Article 6 is the library's article. There's one section in here in addition to the appropriations sections, and that is removing the maintenance of effort for libraries. And these would be just the libraries that are established in conjunction with a school district and a city. There are two of those, and this would remove the maintenance of effort for both the city and the school district. And then Article 7 is the early childhood education article. Section 1 of the Senate was a Senator Michelle provision that was put on the floor that requires that increases in appropriations for the purposes of improving school readiness must be made in research-based programs.
Who did you say the author of that provision was?
Senator Michelle.
Well, that's totally unacceptable to the House. Then we can't have that provision. I'm just kidding. Please continue.
And it requires that the appropriations be consistent with the framework under 124D-142, which is the quality rating system. And Mr. Chair and Member, Sections 1 of the House and 2 of the Senate are the appropriations that were discussed in the spreadsheet.
Mr. Chair and Members, Article 8 is the prevention article. Section 1 in the House bill changes the minimum population requirement for a school district to require a community education director to hold a proper license. The current limit in law is that a district with 2,000 people or less is exempt from the criteria. The proposed change in the House would push that limit to 10,000 people or less. The next section is simply the appropriations section. Mr. Chair and members, Article 9 is the self-sufficiency and lifelong learning article, and the first change here has to do with the adult basic education program. This program essentially has a, under current law, has a growth factor factored into that program. If you can see on the in the bill itself on line 82.5 on the House side, that growth factor is currently, part of that growth factor is currently 3%. It's the lesser of that or the average growth in statewide contact hours. The House is taking that growth factor down to zero, to one essentially. As a result, adult basic education would remain at the current levels of funding for future years.
And Mr. Chair and members, the Senate reduces the growth factor as recommended by the governor from 3% down to 2%, and then picks up Section 2, which also just deletes some obsolete language from previous years. And then Sections 2 of the House and 3 of the Senate are the appropriations sections.
Mr. Chair and members, in Article 10, all of the sections that appear in Article 10 in the revisor's document, the appropriation sections aside, have to do with transforming the Perpich Center for Arts Education into a charter school.
Madam Chair and members, I think that brings us to Article 11. Article 11 is the most exciting article of the bill. This is the forecast adjustments for the previous biennium. And I believe that, unless I'm wrong, Mr. Crow, these are identical on both sides.
With that, are there any questions from members of the committee? Senator Olson, do you have any comments on anything?
No, I'm just glad we're done with the walkthrough.
Yeah.
Take care.
Super. Okay, so next on the agenda, what we have is we're going to be taking testimony on the school grading portion of the bill. Also, if the department wishes to discuss the innovation and accountability portion of the governor's recommendation, the Governor's Excellence in Education Award, feel free to offer that. But at this time, we'll be taking testimony on this portion of the bill. I have Representative Myra as well as four testifiers listed. Is Mr. Nathan here yet? Oh, sure. Mr. Crow, can you direct us to what article and what pages for members of the committee to follow along for the language?
Article 2.
So Section members 5. Will be in Article 2, and staff is telling me we'll be on page R11. That begins at Section 5, right, Mr. Strom?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay, well, Mr. Nathan's not here yet, so Jim Bartholomew. Representative Myra. We're on to the school grading portion, so. Representative Myra, how are you?
Well, thank you.
Good. Actually, we have a member of the public who wished to testify. Is it Peggy Clark? Yeah, why don't you come on up here? We always like it when real people come to testify. So, Representative Meyer, is it okay if we have Ms. Clark testify in this? You bet. The people who get paid here come down here quite a bit. We listen to them, too, but we really like it when real parents come. So please come forward. Do we have another chair for Ms. Clark that you can use? Or perhaps reporters could give up their chair that they've taken from the table. Tisk, tisk. Wonder if that'll make the 6 o'clock news tonight. Do we have microphone? There we go. Do we have a house microphone so we can get them on tape? There should be a microphone at the table.
Sitting over there.
Is that it right there? Is there a page here?
No, we don't have a page today.
Oh, pageless, huh? And other duties as assigned, Mr. Solon.
That's what I went to law school for.
He is the SCA, the Super Committee Administrator. I have no idea where that plug. I have no idea where that plugs in.
There's something over there. Oh, no, that's just the
breakfast. Hey, you used to be a CA. Where does it plug in?
Try under the trash can. Rebecca, try under the trash can and see if there's something. They find one on the wall.
That was me, sorry. Rebecca, this is the voice in your head. While we're waiting, we could just invite Ms. Clark to sit at the table and just offer her testimony there. Is that acceptable to members of the committee? Until we have a page show up and tell us how we're doing this. Go ahead and pull one of those microphones for you. And welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the record.
My name is Peggy Clark, and I live in Minneapolis. I'm a Minneapolis public school parent. Previous to that, I did have a child in St. Paul non-public school. I've been a parent since 1988, so I've been around for a long time. Thank you very much, Chair Garofalo, and members of the committee for allowing some testimony today on this topic. I do really appreciate the work that you're all doing in terms of education reform. I think you have a lot of issues out here that are really important, and I'm glad to see that you're spending time and effort and your collective intelligence on coming up with some solutions to increase accountability in our educational system. That said, however, whenever I look at the proposal here, I see that we're laser focused on math and reading, which is certainly important, but education is about educating the whole child. And if we're going to have a system put in place that is going to be representative of a school or a district, I really feel like you need to have measures in there that cover the whole child experience, which would include the arts and social studies and music and all of the extracurricular activities that children come to value in their educational experience. I also think that an asset-based approach is really important whenever you're talking about grading schools and districts. So much of what happens today to our children feels extremely punitive, not only to our teachers and our staff that work really hard every day to educate our children, but also to the kids themselves. Whenever their school is labeled as underperforming or inadequate, or it gets a D because not every single student in their school is performing at the same level, it's really disheartening to our children and to their peer group. And I would just really encourage you to do whatever you can with any of these reward and recognition systems, that it focus on the positives that we have to offer our children and our staff that work really hard every day to make sure that all of our students have an excellent opportunity for a quality education. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Clark. Representative Myra, is the microphone working for you? You want to test it out?
Sure.
Good morning, Mr. Chair.
Tap on it once.
No. Is that working?
It is.
Oh, it is. All right.
Welcome to the committee, Representative Myra.
Good morning.
You could just provide a brief overview of your bill, and I know we have some additional testifiers who wish to testify in your bill.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My bill, A through F grading of schools and school districts, is modeled after the Florida formula that has been highly successful. It is a grading of schools based on student performance, both on their proficiency, 50% on their proficiency, and 50% on their learning growth. It also has an incentive for schools that are graded A, and also those schools that show one grade level improvement in 1 year or two grade level improvements in 2 years. And that is a $100 per pupil award that is distributed directly to the school and used for staff bonuses, licensed staff bonuses, or possibly equipment that would help the school. I have handed out a brochure on the reading gains that have been seen in Florida. And the summary page, it's in color, summarizes the information that is in the packet. It in the first column, your group of columns, is the overall improvement in NAEP fourth grade reading scores in Florida, Minnesota from 1992 to 2009. Overall, the Florida scores are in yellow for the Sunshine State. Overall, Florida had improved 18 points on the test between 92 and 2009. Minnesota improved 2 points. And in 2009, Florida had 3 points higher score, average score, than Minnesota. Moving to the white students, during that time period, 92 to 2009, white students gained 15 points in Florida. Minnesota students during that same, white students in that same time frame, gained 7 points. And overall, Florida's students outscored Minnesota students in that time in 2009 by 3 points. The dramatic results are seen in the minorities, and this is so encouraging to me. With black students, between 92 and 2009, black students gained 26 points in Florida. At the same time frame, Minnesota black students improved 6 points. And in 2009, Florida students outscored Minnesota students by 16 points. The results for Hispanic students is even more dramatic. From 1992 to 2009, Florida students gained 16 points. In that same time period, Minnesota Hispanic students lost 8 points. And in 2009, Florida Hispanic students outscored Minnesota Hispanic students by 29 points. Economically disadvantaged students did well in Florida's also. From 1992 to 2009, Florida students improved 21 points, while Minnesota students improved 5 points. And in 2009, Florida outscored Minnesota by 14 points. These results are dramatic, and this policy was instituted in Florida in 1999. Previous to that, they had a rating where the schools were given a Roman numeral 1 through 5, and it was always confusing what was the best score. Was it best to be a 1, or was it best to be a Roman numeral 5? When they changed over to the A to F grading of schools, parents got it. They understood it. They knew that an A-graded school was doing well. The students were learning the material, and they were also learning gains. One of the things that has been discussed about the frustration that, well, what if your school is graded an F or a D?
One of the things that they found in Florida is that the community would come around and help that school and make improvements. Rather than having a situation where administration is blaming teachers for poor results, where parents are blaming the administration for not doing its job, and parents are blaming teachers are blaming parents for not preparing their children adequately for school or having them do their homework. Instead, everybody ends up on the same side of the table, working together to improve the school. So it really builds collaboration among all the people interested in the improvement of education for their children. It shows accountability. One of the things that one of the things that happened in Florida is that at the very beginning of when they started grading schools, there were more D and F schools than A and B. And as this progressed, they saw almost immediate improvement in their schools as all the players came together to work together for education for their children. When 80% of the schools were graded A or B, they increased their standards by 5%. And what I find so dramatic is that between 1999 and 2009, over that short period of time, they had to increase their standards 4 times because of the movement of the schools, of the grading, the kids were doing better. And so what we were finding is that the A to F is really spurring them on to improvement in learning gains.
Thank you, Representative Myra. Mr. Nathan, my understanding is you have a tight time frame, so come on down and I'll take your testimony. Representative Myra, if you could just slide the microphone over to me. You could please state your name for the record and who you represent.
Mr. Chair, members of the conference committee, thank you for the opportunity to talk with you briefly today, and thank you also for the accommodation on the schedule. I'm working with a number of schools, and I had some commitments to be out in schools today. My name is Joe Nathan. I direct the Center for School Change at McAllister College. I have been an inner-city public school teacher and administrator in this city. Our children all attended public schools in this city, and I have coordinated a major research project for the National Governors Association at the direction of then-Governor Lamar Alexander, and was invited by George Herbert Walker Bush to be a member of the 20-member Presidential Education Advisory Committee. We met with the President of the United States 7 times and made a series of recommendations. As you know, I've also worked with both district and charter public schools throughout the United States, and I want to strongly endorse the proposal in front of you as a part of what the Governor Bush said yesterday as a part of a suite of reforms. I believe that was his term, a suite of strategies. A suite as in S-U-I-T-E. One can decide whether it's S-W-E-E-T, but it's certainly a suite. And based on our experience, and I am not representing any group, whether it's McAllister or our other organization, just based on our research over the last and work over the last 39 years, part of what we need to do in order to make significant progress is to identify the strategies that are going to have the most bang for the buck. In fact, some of them aren't going to cost significant amounts of dollars, but certainly doing research about which schools are making progress and which are not is significant. You've been nice enough over the last several months to ask me to testify, for example, about what's happening with remedial education. And one of the things that I do want to point out that was in the Florida materials that were distributed yesterday is that they are taking into account not only the test scores of youngsters in Florida in the public schools, but at the high school level, the percentage of students who have to take remedial courses. So I want to strongly affirm 3 basic points. First, as a part of a suite of strategies or a series of strategies, I think that this is absolutely critical for 2 reasons. I think it's critical because it provides valuable information to families and because it provides valuable incentives for educators. People do respond to incentives. So the first point is this is a very important thing to do as a part of a suite of strategies. It provides, secondly, why is it important to do? Because it provides valuable information to families and it provides incentives to educators. The third point, briefly, because I know your time is packed, is that I want to strongly encourage you to recall a number of the other specific things that the governor said. And since you were all there, virtually all of you were there, I don't need to rehearse what he said. But he did say things like providing high-quality early childhood education for all four-year-olds who wanted it. That, and there were a series of other things that he suggested. I know not everyone will agree with that, but our experience in Cincinnati, where we increased overall graduation points by 27 points, and then most recent news is that it's now up 30 points, and the graduation gap between white and African American students has been eliminated, is that you need to use a series of strategies. So, in the interest of time, I will just say I strongly recommend this as one of a series of strategies that will be very helpful for all students in the state, including students who attend schools that have been traditionally viewed as very positive but have, in some cases, significant percentages of students having to take remedial courses once they get to colleges and universities. So those are my points. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Nathan. Next, we have Christy.
Do you have questions?
Yeah, absolutely. Is there any questions for Mr. Nathan? Senator Olson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Nathan, I appreciate your testimony, but we had you missed hearing a parent speak here earlier that had some criticism of this approach that appears to be just using the achievement in reading and math as the measure for the grading and felt it ought to be more comprehensive of all of the whole child kind of approach. What do you have anything to say about the what's the basis for the A through F, and is that the case?
Mr. Nathan.
Mr. Chair and Senator and members of the committee, I believe that you should be commended for bringing in former Governor Bush yesterday, and that I think one of the reasons to do that is to learn from other people's experiences. And in the materials that were distributed, as well as the materials that I verified and talked with people in Florida, they have expanded. They will, for this year, for example, be not just looking at reading and math scores, but they will be looking at issues like high school graduation rates in rating high schools. They will be looking at issues related to percentage of students who have to take remedial courses. And the legislature, in its wisdom, has mandated a yearly report on remediation. So I would encourage the conference committee to take a look at what, in fact, has happened and what lessons have been learned in Florida, so they have slightly expanded this. I think the more accurate information that families have and the more comprehensive information that they have, the better off they are. But I certainly think it ought to be tied to results, but it results in a variety of ways.
Mr. Nathan, have they seen, I haven't had a chance to study to see if they were experiencing some of these strong results implementing this. Well, this, you're, I think, wise in saying it's a suite of strategies. It's kind of hard to nail it down to one particular one. But even if they started with just the reading and math as a part of it, do you feel that that has contributed to changed behavior with educators, parents, and even community?
Mr. Nathan.
Mr. Chair and Senator, I think that it has contributed. At the same time, when people come to Minnesota and say, well, what have you learned about, for example, charter schools or post-secondary options, we can say, here are some things we've learned over a number of years, and if we were starting fresh, here are some things that we would include. So my recommendation is to include multiple measures, not just reading and math. Is it valuable for families to know about the reading and math scores? Absolutely. But my recommendation is to really learn from states such as Florida in this regard.
Thank you. I have to comment that last week, all the days, maybe it's longer than that, we had a break in here, that the head of the founder of Teach for America was in town for the Minnesota meeting. And I happened to be visiting with some folks there, and one of them was a gentleman who was teaching at the Minneapolis Community and Technical College, and he is teaching, he's a math teacher, and he was teaching remedial math, and he said, it's amazing how that has grown in terms of their need for math. He said, actually, it's arithmetic. And I thought, you know, that is, I didn't raise these issues to be critical of reading and math, but those are the two core areas, and you know I've been like a pit bull on the reading and the literacy, that we really have to sharpen up and equip, be sure our teachers are equipped with strategies that will help all learners that learn, because they're struggling in both of those areas. And those are the two foundational areas for just about everything else. And so I think it's really critical that we do make some key changes. And you're reinforcing that this approach at least is one tool to help move down that path. Is that what I'm hearing?
Yes, for Nathan.
I mean, I've been trying to dig deeper, because how are teachers being prepared to do it? Are they being equipped, or are we handicapping them from the day they enter the classroom because they're not having all of the tools they need for going forward? But anyway, that's my little spout, but I think we are on common ground in so many areas, Nathan, that appreciate what
Mr. Chair and Senator, briefly, there is a disconnect in this state between the math and the reading requirements in terms of what it takes to get out of high school and what it takes to be prepared for college. And we have talked about this in the past. And this is one of the areas. So just because a youngster can pass the state math test doesn't mean, and graduate, doesn't mean that she or he is ready for college as measured by what the Minnesota State College and University System uses, the AccuPlacer. Moreover, we don't currently have a statewide math test that a youngster is required to pass in order to graduate. That's one of the discussions that's taking place. So, but even when we did have a math test, there was a disconnect. So I think that we can learn from what Florida did, and I completely agree with you that we need to focus core areas of reading and math. But I think that the added dimension of the study, what the legislature has already mandated and is already in place about remediation, for example, I think that that provides an added impetus to schools. And we've talked about this, about the importance of high schools not being satisfied to have their youngsters passing the reading test. If they have to, they should be looking at the AccuPlacer, and they should be looking at the ACT. We have so many youngsters who are having to take remedial courses, and that includes both youngsters from low-income families and youngsters from much more affluent families. So that's why I'm suggesting that we expand this. One other point on this. We have schools, both district and charter, that specialize in working with kids 9th, 10th, 11th, and 12th grade who have completely failed, or mostly failed, in more traditional schools earlier on. And I think that we need to learn by what they're doing in Florida, where they are taking some of those things into account. So if a school has, and the governor talked about the importance of using the bottom 25% and checking to make sure that there was progress, not just overall, but with the bottom 25%, so that those kids weren't ignored. So I think that we need to include that lesson from Florida as well. That is, not label a school an F school if it is producing 2 or 3 years of gain with youngsters who are far behind. So again, my point is, Florida has been doing this for a number of years, and they've learned some things, and I'm just encouraging the legislature and its wisdom to make use of some of those lessons.
Well, I appreciate it. You know, we are trying to correct a lot of these things at the high school level, and I guess it does say to me that perhaps we're not laying the strong enough foundation earlier, and it's an awful lot harder to do it later than it is to do it earlier. And I hope that we can continue to keep some focus there, because it will make it a lot easier to have better results in graduation and reducing remedial and all these kinds of things all along the way. And I think we all have other ways we'd rather spend that money in education than having to correct if we haven't been able to get it right earlier. So I'm going to keep searching, and I welcome anybody else's push in that direction and counsel as well. Thank you.
Senator Nelson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Nathan, you've mentioned a couple times a suite of strategies And I know we don't have time for you to go into great detail on what that, all of those strategies within that suite, but could you identify for us just briefly what you think those tools would be or what those strategies would be that would be in that suite of strategies for improvement and excellence?
Mr. Nathan, before I call you, you're a doctor, right?
Yes, sir.
I'm mistakenly calling you Mr. Nathan. I'm sorry, Dr. Nathan. You worked for it. You earned it. I might as well.
Well, Mr. Chair, Joe is fine. So thank you. This is Minnesota, and, but thank you. So, Mr. Chair and Senator, the I thought that the presentation that Governor Bush gave yesterday, which obviously you heard, contained a number of very significant strategies. So the legislature is going to have to work with the governor on this, and there is considerable overlap. Here are five critical things that I would encourage. The opportunity for high-quality early childhood education with ties to elementary schools. Arthur Reynolds and others here in Minnesota have pointed out very positive results that are not enough, by themselves, but high-quality early childhood. You have the parent-aware ratings. If we're talking about parent-aware ratings grades at the elementary and secondary level, shouldn't we talk about parent-aware ratings at the early childhood level? And I think the answer is yes. Families deserve good information. Our granddaughter here in Minnesota benefited from the parent-aware ratings. So I would say the parent-aware ratings at the early childhood level as a part of the legislature's effort to encourage ratings to help families understand what are good options, and because we've seen that a number of early childhood programs have worked hard to earn 4 stars. So parent-aware ratings and more availability of high-quality early childhood education for all low-income, limited English-speaking youngsters. High quality. Not all early childhood programs are high quality, and the governor developed and had described some very important things that they've done to reward high-quality early childhood programs and tie them back to what percentage of those kids are prepared in reading, prepared in literacy when they enter kindergarten. So that's one. A second one, I believe that there's probably no person in the state who spent more time than Senator Olson on calling the public's attention over the last 20 years to the importance of reading the effort that the governor has recommended to ensure that youngsters are reading by the end of the third grade, the effort that Senator Olson, members of the legislature. I won't repeat what Senator Olson just said because the research is so overwhelming that she's right. Having youngsters read by the end of the third grade produces far greater rewards than almost anything else other than perhaps high-quality early childhood, but it can't be seen by itself. The third is that we have a lot of strong options in the that the legislature has worked on, post-secondary, charter, cross-district public school choice. I would personally leave it at what we have. I know there are some who would disagree, but I would leave what we have right now. I wouldn't expand further. We have a number of instances of virtual education. I don't think that we need to do what Florida's done to have a statewide virtual program, because we have both school districts and charters that are creating virtual education. But I think that the recommendations that the governor made were generally excellent, and would just want to highlight the early childhood, the first grade, and the ratings.
Thank you.
Any other questions for our testifier? Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Nathan. Appreciate you coming in. Our next testifier is Dr. Christy Hovanitz. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record so 100 years from now we know who you are.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Christy Hovanitz. I am currently the Senior Policy Fellow for the Foundation for Excellence in Education. Just for clarification, I am a Minnesota resident, born and raised here, graduated from the Osseo Area Schools, Park Center Senior High, went to St. Cloud State University, have a degree in education and math, and maintain my teaching license here in Minnesota. Graduated from the University of Minnesota with a master's degree in public policy and a PhD from Florida State University in public policy. most of you I saw yesterday at the governor's visit. I'm here to talk about the Florida experience. I spent 8 years working and actually implementing the school grading system in the state of Florida. Would like to just highlight some of the features of it and then respond to any Florida-specific questions that you may have about our experience, the things that we may or may not have changed as we started to embark on the program, and that's all. So start with the presentation, or would you like to leave with questions? I believe you actually have a handout provided to you. And just want to point out some of the key highlights of the program. One of the key components of our school grading system is the transparency of the system. We have been grading schools since the mid-90s in Florida, and even before we had Roman numerals, we had some categorical representations of schools, either critically low-performing or low-performing, effective, highly effective, and it didn't really provide a lot of information to people, and nobody really paid attention to them. So our school grading system had been in place with the previous governor's administration, Democratic administration in the state of Florida. The only thing we did was change it from a categorical and Roman numeral system to an A through F system. One of the main important things about the school grading system is that this is a summative measure of how well the schools are doing overall at the end of the year. It needs to be a simplistic measure that people can understand and be able to absorb, and be based on what is important, and that's improving student achievement. So our school grading system is based half on achievement and half on learning gains. You all are fortunate. You already have all of your comprehensive assessments in place. When we started our school grading system, our grading system was only based on performance. We only had assessments in grades 4, 8, and 10. When we wrote our legislation, we started grading schools based on that, and then later added in the learning gains components when we had them available. We know that the learning gains components definitely levels the playing field, because we know all children can learn at least a year's worth of knowledge in a year's worth of time, given the appropriate instruction. So we focused in on reading and math. Those are definitely our core subjects and very important subjects. They're also the subjects where we have continuous information from grades 3 through 10, in the case of Minnesota, in grades 3 from 8, to be able to calculate learning gains. We've also included science and writing in our school grading formula because we have information about student performance at elementary, middle, and high school grades for those two components. The focus on the lowest 25% was also critical for us. It's the main way we closed the achievement gap in Florida. Focusing on the lowest 25% of students in each school, rather than focusing on subgroups, ensures that you're reaching the students that aren't reading, and every single school has the lowest 25%. So that was a very critical component for us, as well as maintaining half on proficiency and half on school grades. One of the other things to really focus on is setting the standards when you're grading schools. This is definitely a policy decision. You can calculate the percent of students that are proficient and making progress in each of our 8 subcomponents. But when you want to assign a grade, you have to ensure that that grade is meaningful. And working in Florida back in 1999 when we first started grading schools, and having a governor tell us, I am comfortable and okay with saying we have more D and F schools based on our current grading system, because that's consistent with where our NAEP results were, that was consistent with where our graduation rate was, that was consistent where we were on all nationally normed reference tests that we were taking into account. He was confident that as soon as we started holding schools accountable for student performance, were explicit on what we expected from schools, that their performance and strategies would change. And you can see in 1999, we in fact did have quite a few more D and F schools than we did A or B schools. 677 D and F schools compared to only 515 A and B schools.
Doctor, you're on page 15 of your presentation right now?
Correct. Okay, thank you. And you can see that today, when we grade schools, we have 4 times as many A and B schools as we did back in 1999, and we have less than a third, the number of D and F schools that we did in 1999. And in fact, you can see that that first year after we started grading schools in 2000, we switched that. We had more A and B schools than we did D and F schools. So being able to set a standard that's aspirational but attainable, And being able to set high standards for schools is very important. The other critical element that Representative Myra stated is that we didn't just set a standard and leave it where it was. We set a standard and made sure that we continued to raise the bar, so we continued to improve student achievement. You'll see four dotted lines along this continuum. Each of those arrows indicates a time where we increase the standards on school grades. And each of those times, you can see that we still had more schools that earned A and Bs 1 or 2 years after we increased the standards. One of the other programs that was tied to it was a school recognition program. One of the things we wanted to do was be able to incentivize schools for improving their school grades and improving student performance. And so we provided $100 per student for every school that earned an A or improved a school letter grade. Sounds, you know, like a large money. It was less than 1/4 of 1% of our education budget. So it was a very small amount of money in the scope of education, so we weren't taking a lot of money away from a program to incentivize this, but it did become a mantra that schools wanted to earn this money. The legislative intent was that this money go to staff bonuses. The way it was actually written into law is it could be used for non-reoccurring expenditures, but the intent was specifically for staff bonuses. And so 85% of those funds are currently used to reward teachers in high-performing schools and schools that improve their letter grade. So if a school goes from an F to a D, they earn $100 per student in order to reward their teachers. One of the other things we had talked about, and this is following up just on Dr. Nathan's talking about the cocktail of reforms that Florida implemented, was the options for students to opt out of failing schools. If a school was an F school 2 out of 4 years in the grading system, they had an option to choose another public school or private school, either within or outside of their school district. That came with transportation. There were very, very, very few students who actually took advantage of this option. 2.7 million students in the entire state of Florida, only 753 actually took an opportunity scholarship option. Everybody was afraid that kids would just leave all of our D and F rated schools, or F rated schools, and just go to another higher performing public school. That was not the case. Parents didn't want to send their kids outside of their neighborhood school district. One of the things that we saw, and this was back in 1999 when we had our first opportunity scholarships available out in Pensacola in Escambia County, we had two schools that had students eligible for opportunity scholarships. They were very close proximity in the community, Spencer Bibbs Elementary and A.A. Dixon Elementary. The school was frustrated. The school was upset. They were doing exactly what you said, blaming people, talking about parents aren't sending their kids ready, administration's not doing their job, teachers aren't working. The community stepped in, and the attitude in that school completely changed. They didn't want F schools in their community. And so they came in, they had parent council meetings, they revised the way they looked at the school, how they treated the school. Businesses, the community, parents, teachers, and administration rallied around these two schools, and within 2 years, these schools were C schools. And so all it took was support from the community and timing to not continuously call them failing or poor performing schools. It was just looking at the practices, why they weren't successful as they currently were, and changing some of those things. A lot of the staff stayed the same. A lot of the principals stayed the same year after year. It was just a change in the way they administered their educational practice. School grading in Florida has definitely changed the way we talk about education. When you go out the day that school grades are released, you will see every single marquee board in the state of Florida has their school grade posted on it. You drive by an elementary school, it's we're an A 10 years in a row, or we've improved our school grade this year to a B. It's reported in newspapers. Everybody talks about it. The first day we release the school grades, within 24 hours, our website has over 1 million hits in a 24-hour period of people checking what their school's grade was. We have legislators that have, most of the legislators reward the schools in their districts with special appearances, with certificates, with A-plus flags. It's become a very big thing in the state of Florida to celebrate school grades and what's happening.
Dr. Hovanitz, is that a form of punishment for the children, or what is exactly that? Just kidding. Please continue.
Our media outlets are also very interested in this. Our realtors are very interested in this. It is a very big deal in Florida. One of the things we found is, obviously, when you can start to implement a reform like this, not everybody is really excited about being graded or being graded publicly. But after 12 years of implementing these reforms, some of you may be familiar with some of the legislation that was implemented last year or proposed last year on teacher effectiveness and tying teacher pay for performance to student results. And one of our main opponents in Florida throughout the years has been the Florida Education Association, and their main rebuttal for why we would not want to do teacher performance pay is because we have so many A schools in Florida. We obviously are performing well. And so people, everybody, has really embraced the use of school grades and what school grades mean in Florida.
Thank you, Doctor. Is there any questions for Dr. Havana?
Senator Olson? Dr. Havana, you've got a foot in Minnesota as well as in Florida. Have you tracked or followed at all when Minnesota had a 4-star rating system for schools?
Dr. Havana?
Mr. Chair, yes.
What can you, thank you, Mr. Chair and Dr. Havana. That was abandoned, and can you refresh, or you know, maybe refresh my memory of thinking about what, how was that different than what Florida has done? Now it's 4 stars rather than, that's what they're proposing for the Parent Aware program. But, well, the A through F, I can understand, you know, people at least of certain generations know that meaning. Is it that, or do you know anything about the different elements that were a part of that rating system that would make it different? And I don't know if we've ever tracked data. When we dropped it, did our performance decrease, or... You know, I don't know if we know what happened if we had some of the same kind of results. Were you, did you ever monitor, or has there been any research in comparing that kind of that system?
Dr. Olenitz.
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, to my knowledge, I don't think that there has been an analysis done on pre- and post-star rating system to determine what happened with student performance. The students, or the star rating system was dropped before I had the opportunity to work at the State Department of Education, so it wasn't in existence. A couple of things that'll be a challenge to do that type of analysis is the amount of longitudinal data available on a statewide level pre and post the star rating system, and I'm fairly certain there was not inclusion of learning gains in the star rating system, that it was only performance-based, so it didn't gauge whether or not students were making a year's worth of progress in a year's worth of time.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just curious as to whether there were elements that were missing in that approach. I know that there are still, I think there's still some report cards on site, lots of data, but I mean, part of our challenge is how you wrap that data and how you market it, and I think that's kind of what this proposal is. It's been marketed in a way that's understandable, so it engages people.
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, yes, I would agree that there is information right now on the department's website that demonstrates the percent of students that are proficient or not proficient that meet learning gains, below average or high learning gains, but it doesn't provide a comprehensive rating system for the school or provide information about what it means to have made a learning gain. And I think that's one of the components of the grading system currently used in Florida and several other states right now, is that it provides one overarching, very transparent measure that all of the public can access, and then those that are interested in more information can view the school report cards on the Department of Education website that drills down and provides what percent of students are proficient in reading, writing, math, and science, what percent of students are making learning gains in reading and math, what percent of students are making at least worth a year, you know, learning gains, a year's worth of progress, and a year's worth of time in the lowest 25%, and then disaggregate even further as to the number of students doing each of those very specific tasks and where schools are earning their points. So in Florida, a school could start the year with a lot of very low achieving students and very few students proficient, but a majority of their students make a year's worth of progress and a year's worth of time and be able to earn an A or a B school grade.
Thank you.
Any other questions from members of the committee? Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In Minnesota, obviously, we have the MCAs and we have AYP and so forth. Do they still continue doing a program similar to the AYP in Florida now that this program is in place?
Dr. Ovanitz.
Mr. Chair, yes, we do. This grading system is a good answer to AYP. AYP is a very conjunctive system that looks at multiple subgroups that answers a series of yes and no questions with different standards for different subgroups of students. It's a yes or no measure after looking at, in some cases for comprehensive high schools, close to 40 yes or no decisions. That's a very complex thing for people to know or understand. Not all schools are held to the same standards based on which subgroups of students that they have and who they're actually serving. So in Florida, they still do maintain AYP as well as school grades. We report out our AYP, obviously, as required under No Child Left Behind as a yes or a no provision, but we also report the percent of subgroups met, which is also something that the department's been doing as well. That aligns very well with the schools that earn an A. So AYP, that's schools that have met 90% of their criteria, are highly correlated with A schools in Florida. AYP schools that meet 80% of their AYP criteria are highly correlated with B schools. The differentiation of a graded scale of A through F is a lot more flexible than just simply providing a yes or no answer that doesn't give a lot of information. Most schools aren't making AYP, and most schools will continue to not make AYP, even with safe harbor and growth provisions. So in that looming 2014 deadline, makes it tough. So this is actually a very good response. The other thing is the growth measure for AYP is a growth to a standard measure rather than demonstration of a year's worth of knowledge and a year's worth of time. And a growth to a standard measure is essentially just another way to measure proficiency and being able to track your way there. But that was the U.S. Department of Education's guidelines in order for being able to demonstrate growth. Demonstrating a year's worth of progress means students can make 1 or 2 years worth of progress and not actually reach proficiency, but the school is still rewarded for advancing that student so far throughout the year. So school gradings are just more, school grading is just a more compensatory system that allows schools not to have to meet an absolute standard by an absolute time.
Senator Fabian?
Thank you.
Any other questions for members of the committee? Dr. Ovanitz, thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
The final testifier I have listed is Jim Bartholomew. Welcome to the committee, sir. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, my name is Jim Bartholomew with the Minnesota Business Partnership. And I'll be quick and not reiterate much of what you've already heard, other than we'd like to encourage you to adopt the A through F rating system. It does, as you've heard, two important things. One, it gives parents and the public some straightforward information about how students and schools are doing. And the other key that you haven't heard quite as much about, but just importantly, is it does recognize schools that are helping schools succeed. I think you have a copy of a school report card from MDE's website. And would just comment, the department's website has a lot of wonderful information about our schools and districts. Unfortunately, it's not very user-friendly. And unless you know specifically to go there, you're not likely to use it because, frankly, there's a lot of stuff, but nothing specific to tell you what you're looking at and what it means. And in fact, if you start looking for information about a school by going to Google, you're most likely to find information from websites like greatschools.com, schooldigger.com, schoolmatters.com. There's a lot of other sources of information about school performance out there, but notably absent is what's available on the department's website. As Dr. Hovenitz mentioned, a key benefit of the rating system is it'll make the state's report card and website more relevant to parents and the public. And once parents begin to use it, they can then take advantage of all the other information that's on the department's website. So it's a great advertisement and entree to a wealth of information that right now most people aren't aware of. And in addition, as has been mentioned, in addition to helping make that information more broadly used, it is better information than what was on the STAR rating system in the sense that it is a combination of proficiency and growth, which is something that we didn't have in 2003 and 4. So that's a distinct advantage. And as Governor Bush mentioned yesterday, I think it was the teller in the bank when the school grades came out and their school was an A. That is a huge role in school improvement, and it's not on when we had our rating system, and I every day would drive by some schools that they were anxious to earn 4 and 5 stars, and when they got 4 and 5 stars, they were anxious to let their communities know about it, and rightfully so. In fact, somebody kept a banner on their school for several years after the star rating system was repealed. And then finally, just mention again, the financial recognition provided through the rating system is key. Giving schools some unexpected funding that they can pretty much spend on their own allows them to do some things that they wouldn't ordinarily be able to do. And for a lot of reasons, we think that's a good thing to do, and it's always good to recognize success. So thank you for your time, and we'd encourage you to support this.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions for the testifier? Thank you. This is a public hearing. Is there any member of the public who wishes to testify on this bill? Are you making your way towards the table? Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record. I don't know if you're walking to the door or not. So.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Mary Ciccone. I'm with Parents United for Public Schools. There's a lot been said this morning that, we have, we agree with. One of the things that Dr. Nathan talked about really pointed to the need for a vision and then a strategic plan to get there. And he talked about the suite of reforms that need to be in place in order to get us there. I couldn't agree more. That's really an important component here. I have a lot of concern that we put one piece in and then say, well, that's good. Now let's track that. A lot of the things that I've been listening to about the Florida model do talk about this suite of reforms and the need for them before we get to this point. It may simply be a philosophical difference, but no matter what, no matter where, this grading system still only points to one test. It only says a school is successful or not based on one test. I think that's concerning. This state prides itself, and rightly so, on having multiple options for parents and families to choose from. This is really a critical decision for parents. It's a really critical decision for children. And I think that the time necessary to help parents understand what should you be looking for in a school? How does it differ between child A and child B? What is a successful school? Reducing that to a simple letter grade, I don't think is productive, and I think it's counterintuitive to Minnesota having multiple options for families. So for that, I think this is a real good beginning, and I do think if there were multiple measures in it, then maybe that would be something, and also as part of this suite that Dr. Nathan was talking about. But just this one provision here, we would oppose. Thank you.
Thank you very much. In your statement, you were supportive of a menu of options and that you're concerned about us doing one thing. Do you really think that Senator Olson and I are going to only let one thing happen this year? Because that's why I've had a lot of concerns brought to my attention, and no one's looked at me and said, Representative Garofalo, I think you're going to do too little this year.
Mr. Chair, one of the things I've learned in the political process is that although it might look like this suite is moving through, that doesn't seem to be the way that it ends up. It ends up being Provision A gets in, Provision B gets dropped, Provision C gets in. That is what the political process seems to do, and that does concern me.
Representative Meyer, do you have any comments? All right, first of all, any questions for our testifier from members of the committee? Representative Meyer, do you have any comments?
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think this is a wonderful provision. The results shown in Florida are really quite exciting, and particularly among minorities. And recently I was doing some research. There's a new study that came out 2 weeks ago saying that among white, black, and Hispanic students, if they are proficient in reading, there is no difference in graduation rates. I think that's so exciting. And we do really highlight reading and math in this rating because they are so important. They're important for attaining any other value in science and in social studies and all the other areas. It causes collaboration and encourages groups to get together, all those interested parties. If a school is rated a D or an F, rating it does not make it a D or an F. It was before it was rated. What rating it does is it makes public, it makes it the school accountable, and it draws attention that there is a need for improvement. And I'd greatly appreciate your support for this. Thank you.
Representative. Are any other members of the public who wish to testify in this bill? Go ahead. If you wish to testify, go ahead and kind of make your way up, and we'll.
Mr. Chair and members,
please state your name for the record.
My name is Roger Ernst, and I represent the Elementary and Secondary School Principals Association. And this bill has been heard in committee as well. But given the format for today, we thought it'd be good to get up and make a couple of comments just to reiterate that. My clients actually think that we've done the labeling piece in Minnesota and nationally as well. We've labeled some schools as turnaround schools with special criteria. We've had AYP labels that we've had for some years now. We've had the STAR system in the past. We've had positive labels. We've done the National Schools of Excellence and the Minnesota Schools of Excellence as well. We don't support the A through F model of labeling the schools for most of the reasons that Ms. Ciccone set out. I do think that, I know it's Florida week, we've been doing a lot of discussion about Florida this week and the things that have been happening in Florida. I think that there is always a concern about talking about data in the particular decision-making model that we use to pass bills here. And why Florida? Why not Massachusetts that appears to do better than Florida on some reasons? And what do they do? And how many other states have the mandatory grading system, and where has that worked? I think those are good questions. They're legitimate questions. I have, and as we sit through these, and Representative Myra's bringing this stuff forward, the underlying issues that she's raising are important for this committee to consider in the broad scope of issues, as Mr. Chair, as you've mentioned, and with Chair Olson as well. So, with that, though, I do have to tell you that the feeling of school principals with regard to the A through F system is not a positive feeling, and so if you're going to have us do this, then we will do it, but we do not foresee the positive impacts of this bill. I think that the proponents do.
Thank you very much, Chair. Any questions for the testifier? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Aronson. I've been reflecting on what Mr. Bartholomew was talking about, the wealth of data that we have, and I know that, you know, as we've been focusing on data quality, we've got virtually, I think, all the pieces in place. I don't know what we've done. I think the point that he was making is that we haven't necessarily made the best use of it or the accessibility of it. Is there anything stopping anybody now from organizing data in ways that speaks more to some of the progress that's being made? And I mean, do you have any suggestions on, not asking you for more? I think it's all in there. And what could be done to organize that to better inform parents? Now, whether you put the A through F or whether you put some other label or whatever, part of this goes back to the fact that we've got all this data. But, some of us turn that on that and your eyes fog over and you have to trying to figure out how you would put this together, how you would that would send a message that would give a little clearer picture of what school is. Would principals object to that kind of thing? And how have you spent any time discussing how you might use existing data? Other than I know that, it wasn't a principal, it was a superintendent that was a bit critical of some of the reports that the department was requiring, and maybe at our hands some statutes that instead of he went into his own district on the department website and pulled off the data and stapled it to the report and sent it back to them. I mean, they already had it. It seems to me that that may be an area that we ought to be giving some attention to in order to, because much of what is here, if we already have this data, it's an exercise of putting that together. And who should do that? Should that be done centrally? Should each school have to collect and organize that to determine what it is? Or how would that best be done? I'm not a techie, so I understand and appreciate when you got a simple message that comes through with good data, it really does help in making good decisions.
Mr. Ahrens.
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, it is unacceptable, given the technology that we have today, that the data is so difficult to sort through for the parents that are picking a school, for the teachers that are working in them, for you folks that are making the policy decisions about them. I sat in the back of the room while Representative Myra was bringing her bill forward to see if I could find online what Florida's graduation rates were versus what Minnesota's graduation rates were. That would be a good fact to know in assessing this bill. I found some reports that if I could pay for them, they'd mail them to me. That data should be easily available to make those comparisons, you know, and it is too complex. And you're right. That data should all be there. And what use is made of it is something else. But it should be organized, easily accessible, you know, and to the extent that it's not, those issues should be changed promptly. I think you're right about that. I think the data does exist, that there's a tremendous amount of data there. You know, the question is, how do we organize it? I'm not sure that I think one of the things that disturbs, would principals object to, was one of your questions? Absolutely not. I mean, I think what test scores are in an individual school, those ought to be known. What's happening in an individual classroom in terms of the progress and the value added that's going on in that classroom, I think everyone would agree that that's known. I think that with the evaluation bills that have been circulating around, it's a legitimate expectation that principals' evaluations will have contained in them somewhere the test scores from their schools on an annual basis would be in those evaluations. So they can look at them and reflect where the strengths and weaknesses are. There's a little bit of a problem with relative arbitrary assignments, you know, the letter grade piece, that we say you're a C. Education Week does this nationally. They rank state education systems in a letter grade system. Nationally, the average is D minus. What does that mean? What does that tell us? Minnesota and Florida, in that particular evaluation, are both Cs. I think Minnesota's maybe a C minus and Florida's a C. But does that tell you something for making a policy decision about whether or not Representative Myra's bill is an idea that you should make the law in Minnesota? That's too summarized. And I think you do need the actual data. It should be organized into an 8.5 by 11 relative to particular schools and districts, so that people would be able to know, you know, what's going on in this school, what's interesting about this school, what might I like, and why would this be a good decision to send my child to this school, or what intervention should happen in this school to make it a better school. And those are good questions, and it needs to be organized. I think the department is the centralized place to do that, but we don't talk about that very much, and you know, and they're underfunded, and those other issues that you know, but that ought to be a primary mission, I would say, out of the department.
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Aronson, I think there's one guru over there that has organized financial data.
Mm-hmm.
That has made it that very accessible and rather interesting if people tracked in. And he came in and demonstrated that to us at our committee. I think that we need to go beyond that. But sometimes it isn't. It's somebody who's catches that vision. You know, I wish we had some of these graduate students that are out there instead of writing and wanting us to do surveys of how we're adjusting to legislative life and managing our life during the legislature. Well, I do it by not responding to surveys. if there are some of these could get some energy and devote it toward organizing, you know, the vision that Ms. Ciccone was talking about is, I think, rather critical. And if we don't have some of those pieces together, the implementation is the place where it falls apart. And that's true in just about any innovation. As we've been talking about, even the reading and literacy, the Reading First was a really good program. It got sabotaged in the implementation. You do have to have the pieces together. And I think in this one in particular, I'd like us to not ignore what we ought to be doing and being sure we're setting the stage for getting good data that is able to communicate whatever course of action we choose as to how it's labeled.
Just one comment, Mr. Chair, with your indulgence. Your citation of the finance data that comes from the department is well taken. And if you think of the committee's own experience, how much you value the quality finance data that you get to make the decisions that you're making. It's essential. And it is so, it's so helpful to have that. So I think your point's well taken, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Convey that to some others.
Representative Erickson, and then we will go to, I thought I saw a member of the public who wished to testify. So Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Erickson, what is the attitude of the principals who belong to your organization about testing? Is it positive? Is it negative? Are they ambivalent? Because attitude has a lot to do with how a school performs on testing.
Mr. Erickson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Erickson, I think there's a deep concern about the amount of time that is taken for testing, and that to the extent that that's time taken away from instruction, that we've gone too far on some of that. I think there are concerns about higher end kids who are basically taken out of the instruction loop while we're preparing for the test. I mean, all the things that you know, Madam Chair, as a teacher, but I think there's a deep concern about that. I know that when there were discussions of testing reform, initially when Governor Dayton met with the principal associations and said, we're going to talk about reducing the number of statewide tests, that was met with cheering. So I think obviously there's a value to it and there's a need for it and there's a demand for it and that's recognized. But I think in this circumstance, the phrase would be less is more.
Mr. Erickson? Well, I didn't get the opportunity to give MCAs when I was still teaching, but I did deliver the writing test. And I set my students up for the test in such a way that this was going to be the best piece of writing they would do during their term with me. And in fact, that was true for all sophomores. We addressed it that way. And as a result, they really did take it very seriously. And I think what has happened in our schools, and I had some visits all over the holiday with some of my school administrators, is that there's such a negative attitude about the MCA testing that students dislike it intensely, and that comes out in their test results. And so I think, you know, as the department and we look at, are there going to be some changes in at least the MCA tests, might we also consider what should we in the field, and I was in the field, so I'll say we, how should we relate the message to our students that actually this test, whether it's the writing test or an MCA or it's the math grad or whatever, how important is that as a reflection on what they've learned and, first of all, what I've taught, because there's no learning unless I've done a good job of teaching, but there is no learning either unless the student has taken what I've taught seriously and found it important. So, you know, I think that has to weigh into any further discussion. And I would think that if I have a school that does, I have a couple of schools in my district that do superbly well on MCAs, and I really think it's related to the attitude. As I talk to those principals and those teachers, they really take it very seriously and convey that to their students. And perhaps, and I was a reader of tests while I was on my hiatus, I saw the attitude come out in what the students did in those tests as I read tests from other states. Oh, my goodness, I could tell which set of tests teachers had really promoted this as being valuable to the students understanding what they learned and those in which the student said, this is just, you know, and I won't use the words they used in some of their writing, but I think we have to consider that.
Thank you, Representative Erickson. Mr. Erickson, thank you for your testimony. So our final testifier of the day, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record, and please proceed with your testimony. Thank you very much.
My name is Annette Wallen-Hokanson, and I am one of those who is in the trenches presently.
I am a mother of three children who are in the public schools, and I have been a teacher for over 20 years. I presently teach fourth grade in the Osseo School District in a school that would be considered a high-needs school. And we just got done with MCAs and can tell you that my students love the MCAs because we don't assign homework during those days. They get to eat a mint before they begin. And we tell them, this is when you get to show what you know and what I have helped you to learn. Overall, we as teachers, we are not afraid of hard work. To be here today, I spent over 2 hours going through lessons and making sure that everything was in place for my substitute today, so that those children, even though I was gone, still had a positive learning experience. But to grade our schools based on test scores and not take into account the realities of these students is a faulty practice. I think that there are many factors that influence gains in students and influence their progress in school. And those factors include mobility, mental health issues, class sizes, parent involvement, poverty, English language learners. And what I see in this grading system of A through F is not an addressing of those realities. I teach in a classroom of 31 fourth graders in my homeroom. I had, before some of them moved, I had 36 in my math class in fourth grade. These are students that we have over 60% free and reduced lunch in our school, about 70% minority population, and there is quite a bit of mobility in our school. It is not an easy school to teach in, but we still work hard so that each one of these students can gain. I'll tell you, it would be a lot easier to work in a school where kids don't live in poverty. It would be easier to teach in a school where you know they're coming to school prepared. It would be easier when you're not dealing with kids who are wondering where they're going to live next month. And I think that the reality is that those schools where there is a stable population, when they aren't dealing with hunger issues, when they aren't dealing with mobility, those kids are going to make gains that are more difficult for those students who have those strikes against them. Does that mean that they can't make gains? No. And that's my job in the classroom, to do whatever I can to help those students to learn. But to label my school not as an A because of the factors that those students bring in that is no fault of theirs, and we deal with them the best that they can, to label my school, I think, is a faulty practice. And I would encourage, I urge you to take a look at the realities that funding does influence some of those issues. Class sizes are a reality, and in the report that has come through from Florida, one of the things that they did is they put money into reducing class sizes. I'll tell you, having 31 fourth graders in my room with some real mental health issues that I am not fully prepared to address, that's a reality. I thank you for the opportunity to testify as one who, like I said, is in the trenches right now and working hard so that our children are prepared for life after high school.
And what was your last name?
My name is Annette Wallen Hokanson.
Wallen-Hulkinson. Okay.
Correct.
Ms. Wallen-Hulkinson, thank you for your testimony. And one of the nice things about this session is that when you look at the total amount of money being proposed for education funding from Governor Dayton, from the House, and from the Senate, we are, for all practical purposes, almost identical in our number. Funding levels that we are proposing, at least in the House and from the Senate numbers, are about 99.7% of what Governor Dayton's proposing. So one of the nice things that's happening in the conversation this year is that usually we have a lot of the oxygen sucked on the room about how much we're going to be spending. And this year, the debate really isn't about that because we're virtually identical. The focus is more on what the policy, how are we going to be changing things. And so we appreciate it's one of the nice things this year. We're in a fortunate place, despite the fact that we've got a $5 billion deficit. Again, that focus on how we're going to be doing things differently is nice. And in the Osseo School District, I just looked up the numbers, at least, and these are just the House numbers. Despite the fact that we've got a budget deficit, the per-pupil funding formula for Osseo, we're able to go from $10,390 in fiscal year 11, that's the one we're in right now, to $10,485 and then $10,586 in fiscal years 12 and 13. So the fact that at a time when we're, again, having income go down, unemployment go up, very difficult economy, to be able to provide Osseo with more dollars per pupil than in previous years, something that I think it demonstrates on a bipartisan, bicameral, between both the executive and legislative branches, a commitment to education funding.
And I appreciate that. However, I am aware that some of these monies are being shifted from programs that were being funded into other things.
It is true that there's different categorical aids, mm-hmm. and the monies are moving around, but when you consolidate all the money together and you look at it, if you look at the fiscal year 11 number that we're in right now, Osseo is $10,390. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the fiscal year 12 number, at least under the House proposal, it's $10,485. So, again, given the given the budget situation we're facing and some of the other things that are going on.
Right. Chairman, I do want my message not to be overall about funding.
Sure.
My message is more that different schools have different populations of children. They do. And some populations are more difficult. And if I was in, for instance, a Wayzata school, it would probably, in the schools I'm thinking of, it might be easier to get those kids to gain a year than it is at the school that I'm in, at Edinburgh Elementary, working twice as hard because of those factors that influence those children. Poverty, hunger, housing, mental health issues. That those children, I'm just using Wayzata as an example, don't have to deal with. And so that's the reality of this A through F grading that I think is not taken into consideration, that children are children, but they have different needs based on the families that they have come from and the places that they live. And am I, as a teacher, going to be graded as less effective? I take it as a grade on my performance, A through F. If we've worked as hard as we can and we have not been able to overcome those obstacles that those children have come in with. That's my message. And yes, funding, I believe, does need to address those things, class sizes, mental health, having social workers, having psychologists, those kinds of things. But children are not all apples to apples from one school to the next. And that is my message.
Thank you very much for your testimony. And we did run out of time, so we weren't able to hear from the governor's office or the executive branch. But I did want to thank Governor Dayton, Commissioner Casilius, for putting forward the Governor's Excellence in Education Award that would provide grants and awards to school districts based on test performance. And I think that if you take a look at the governor's proposal for Excellence in Education Awards, where he's offering financial incentives, and you look at Representative Myra's bill and the school grading, I think that there's some common ground there where we can provide those awards and acknowledgments to school districts that are demonstrating that and have a proven track record of improving student achievement. Representative Myra, do you have any closing comments?
Yes, I do. Mr. Chair, members, parental involvement is so important, so crucial for a child's education. And one of the things about grading a school, even with a star system, it really brings out the parents. They want to know what's going on at their child's school. I understand that at the 2003 State Fair, there was a line that formed all the way around the department building because parents wanted to see how their schools were graded. We need to encourage parental involvement. So often when I've talked to teachers, and I've talked to very many of them, they say, you know, we could do such a better job in education if the parents were involved. Well, this is a means of getting them involved, having them be aware of what's going on. And again, it is a matter of collaboration, of everyone working together, not parents, teachers all by themselves having to struggle with issues, but getting the parents involved, administration all working together for the improvement of the schools. And thank you for your time.
Thank you, Representative Myra. Excellent closing comments. Senator Olson, did you have any closing remarks? Members, with that, we are adjourned. Thank you.